gentlemen, it's your boy, Sammy B-Real, and we are back again, the Ghost Lights Podcast. You know what that song is by now. It's the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble song War. If you're familiar with the Hunger Games, it's in that. I would suggest you go onto iTunes now and cop that joint. It is fire. And after all that pomp and circumstance, I'm going to tone down the cool man rhetoric and welcome Haley Johnson to the Ghost Lights.
Hello. Hello, all.
Hello. That's right. Hello to all of my listeners, all 90 of you.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's more people than I know, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping those are likes on the Facebook page. So I can only assume that by what my SoundCloud is telling me, they're not going there to listen to these amazing interviews. You are guest technically number 12.
12?
Yes.
I think that's a lucky number somewhere.
That's got to be a lucky number.
I'll take it.
Definitely. Tonight's episode is brought to you by Sanan Pinot Gris, made in the wonderful Columbia Gorge of Oregon. Sorry, St. Paul, Oregon, but their vineyard is called Columbia Gorge. It's a beautiful Pinot Gris. Are you enjoying it thus far?
It's fantastic. Let's nice. Drink more.
There will be more. There's also a bottle of red in case we get through this really quickly. Bang. First things first, I've got to ask you the question that's been on everybody's mind since it happened. What did you think? Spoiler alert, the first episode of The Walking Dead.
Season 7 premiere.
Yes, the season 7 premiere.
I think I can probably talk about it now. It's taken about 3 weeks for me to calm down.
Chris Hardwick has never led me to believe that you can just do that. So I always say spoiler alert.
Agreed.
Yes.
But also emotionally, it's taken me this long.
Okay. I would agree with you.
It was rough, you know. I mean, we knew some bad stuff was going to go down. We were prepared for the 6 or 7 months leading up to it as well as you could be. But I still think it was a pretty massive shocker for everybody. Mm. And obviously, you know, if you read the comics, which I actually do not, but I will start soon, you knew who was going to meet Lucille that way. But the creators for the show have certainly been throwing some curveballs and trying to change up the dynamic so that the comic readers are also getting something exciting with the show.
Yeah.
So kind of didn't assume it was going to go that way. And then we got like a double action, double tap action.
Yeah.
That was upsetting. But even more than just the deaths of some of our favorite characters, for me what was so upsetting was the psychological torture that the rest of the characters were put through throughout the show. Watching Rick, our hero, be completely broken down. No one has ever seen him like that before, even with the loss of Lori.
Yeah.
I never saw him quite, you know, as despondent. So it was a pretty intense episode.
Yeah, definitely. No, you bring up an excellent point. I mean, watching Rick from start to finish, that episode was just traumatic for us because, I mean, at some points, and we grew to lean on him. Like, we were like, I remember, I've watched this show kind of sporadically and then watched the full season and then missed a whole bunch of episodes. One of the episodes that always sticks out in my mind is when they're locked into Terminus's train.
The train car, yeah.
And the last thing he says before the end of that episode, and I was like, it's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay.
I just knew it was going to be okay. And every time they do the cutaways now to the next couple of episodes that are coming, I've got no idea what's going to happen, which you can't really predict with this show, which makes it so much fun. Even if you've read the graphic novel, there's a baseline to it that it's going to stay relatively consistent to, but it's always going to take a turn.
Yeah, they want to surprise the viewers as much as they can.
Yeah.
Well, it was interesting because all of season 6, we were watching Rick pompous and cocky.
Yeah.
And, you know, no one was going to mess with him and his group, and they were going to take care of all the problems. Yeah. I mean, so you knew the inevitable was coming.
Yeah.
No, and I never once was worried about him losing his life. I mean, otherwise the show would either come to a halt. I mean, we've been following him since episode 1, but I knew that his cocky behavior was gonna come and bite him in the ass in the long run.
Oh,
so
yeah. Definitely. It seems with a lot of our beloved characters, hubris is often something we have to worry about.
The Greeks knew what they were talking
Seriously.
About, man.
What? This is a theater 101 lesson about to happen.
I know. I feel like we are. I'm taking a class by Penny Cole. Hi, Penny Cole, out there.
Hi, Cookie Hetzel.
See?
Yeah.
This is UCD and Metro right in this room.
We're doing it.
Aw, see? All the teachers.
All the teachers. We're giving them some love.
That's right.
A question to keep going on the Walking Dead a little bit. There was a thing I kept seeing popping up on Facebook, people being upset by the horrific turn the storylines have gone in terms of the visuals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the grotesque parts of these visuals. What is your take on that?
You know, I actually feel very strongly about the fact, I find it interesting that people have been so upset about it, and I too have been reading articles and reviews and posts about people saying, well, they don't want to watch the show anymore, or they thought it went over the line.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, well, who drew the line and where is the line?
Yeah.
Because if we would have seen the kind of gruesome actions that took place that affected any other character in the show rather than our group, no one would have batted an eye.
Mm.
Or if we would have seen Negan bash the skull in of a walker, no one would have batted an eye. It's the fact that there are people we love and we care about and we've been invested in for all these years, especially someone from episode one, so many years ago. That's why it was so upsetting, and that's why I think people were so, so affected by it, is it was people, they were characters that people knew and loved. Had it been some random person, people would have been like, oh, that's horrible, but oh well.
Yeah, definitely. That's my biggest thing, and you, I like your point a lot, that it had the emotional context to it, who we tied ourselves to.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I was always thinking, where was a show about The Walking Dead supposed to go?
Right.
Especially when years ago they painted this image that The Walking Dead are the people we dubbed as humans still.
Right.
Still capable of, and thank you, Haley, for giving me that nugget of knowledge years ago, because when they said it, I still was like, Haley said,
Oh, that's right.
I'm paying attention now, I guess. But that's kind of how I felt. This is like, where are we supposed to do? I mean, considering worse things happen to people who are technically already dead in that show.
Right.
And then I guess it just would have felt weird if what happens to, spoiler alert, Glenn, happens to him without any, like, if he just hit him and we don't see him.
Right.
Like, that would, I think, would have dumbed it down for us.
It totally would have.
And considering the effort it took for him to say anything to Maggie was something I really needed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I needed, like, why is he going through this? Oh, he's going to say something.
Yeah.
He's going to say it to Maggie because his eye hasn't left her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I also appreciated, you know, assuming people watch The Talking Dead or, you know, read forums and reviews and things, you know, hearing Steven Yeun, who played Glenn, talk about how he was excited and honored to have the death that was attributed to him in the graphic novel, that it wouldn't have been fair for them to give that death to anybody else.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I disagree that Glenn's story was over. I would have loved to have seen that story run its course a lot longer with Maggie and the possible baby. But, you know, if it was his time, it was his time. And at least he went out due to the, you know, the same way the source material gave him. And it was heroic and devastating. And, you know, I mean, I guess that's all you can ask for as an actor, right?
Yeah.
To get, like, the most glorious death possible.
I would, definitely. Well, we can't all go out like Natalie Portman in Black Swan.
We can't.
No.
We can't all do that. And I'm not ever going to pick at a hangnail ever again.
Yeah.
After seeing that movie.
Me neither.
Like, ever.
That's terrifying.
It's horrifying.
Yeah. Yeah. All of it is. Well, thank you so much, reiterating, for you having the time to come and sit down with us. I know Haley Johnson often has a lot on her plate. But it's cool that we can steal you away for a moment and chill with you.
Hanging out with Sammy?
Yeah.
Over a mic and some wine?
Yeah.
Like, who wouldn't want to do that?
I've recorded all of our conversations up to this point anyway.
That's what you've been doing.
Creepy!
I love it.
Yeah! That's what I do. That's what I do. That's going to ruin me for any potential relationships in the future, but hey, I need it for posterity.
Wait, can you edit this out?
No, not at all.
Great.
Not at all.
Well, then, Well, sorry, ladies.
And dudes.
Hey, let's leave it open.
That's right. I mean, I'm not going to pigeonhole myself to anything. I don't like typecasting.
Nobody likes typecasting.
Nobody likes typecasting. For those of you at home, I am pointing at the mic and doing the finger guns.
Pew, pew. Because girls can't make that sound, right? Pew, 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 pew.
No, you can.
No, but what's like, the dudes can make gun sounds. I never was able to make a machine gun sound.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? You can't do that with, like, your tongue?
No, I can't.
I just it just probably sounds look like you're farting in the water.
Which is what I'm better at than machine gun sounds. I mean, let's be honest.
Nice. Well, we will be. We're going to go back to the real reason we brought you here. The big question that I start off every interview with. How did it happen? How did acting happen to you?
Oh, man. You know, it, let's see. I mean, I've been performing since I was a wee child. Mm. I remember being in, like, you know, the Christmas pageant when I was in elementary school. But I never did, like, I was never a child actor. Mm. As in, I was never a child that would go audition for, like, professional companies around town or anything like that. I didn't really, really get passionate about it till high school, which, you know, that's where you pigeonhole people, right? Like, you're a jock, or you're a theater kid, or you're a choir kid, or a band kid, or, you know, honor student, or whatever.
That's definitely where it starts.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, I remember doing plays in school before that, in elementary school and middle school, but always more, like, school-related or after-school programs, never, like, in the community. Mm-hmm. That's why I think it's just so inspiring to see so many young kids in the Denver metro community that are acting and that come out to auditions, and I'm like, wow, I wish I would have done that when I was a kid. Like, opening yourself up to those kinds of opportunities and possibilities at even a younger age. Mm-hmm. Imagine. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was school. It was high school, and then studied it in college, and out of college, just jumped into the community.
What was it about, I mean, what was it that was cool and sparked that?
I don't know. You know, I can't pinpoint one thing specific other than I do remember in middle school in Florida, I was in this after-school program where we would, like, read. It was like a reading-writing workshop, and my teacher, my after-school program teacher, kept telling me, Haley, you're so lively, you're so emotive, you always make facial expressions when you read. I mean, don't you think that you should do some more plays or get involved? I remember that specifically and thinking, oh, that's kind of neat. I don't think before that anything was like yearning in my 11-year-old soul that was like, this is something I have to do.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I remember that specifically, and then I remember doing my first play in high school. I was a freshman. I did Anything Goes, which is crazy because I'm not a singer or a dancer. I don't know how that happened.
Yeah.
But that was really cool. I mean, that was my first high school production. I was in the chorus, and not only just being on stage with the lights and everyone else around you, but all the backstage, like hanging out with your friends and putting on makeup. I mean, all the kind of dumb girly things when I was 14 were really exciting, and the camaraderie-ship, that's not a word, camaraderie.
Okay, yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah, of creating friends and maintaining friends through that medium was really exciting. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of sparked it. And then as I moved through high school, I realized, oh, this is something that's important because it makes me feel alive.
Nice.
So.
So, I mean, that's... explain that alive feeling.
You know, I moved in high school a couple times, and so I didn't grow up in the kind of place where I, you know, knew all the same kids from middle school to high school to, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. So having to make new friends and be in a new community throughout my high school years was tough, but being able to right away move into a new school but get enveloped by the kids in the drama club always felt good. And then, I mean, that felt good. And then on top of that, doing a play that I was like, wow, this is cool, and this makes me feel something, and this makes me think more, and reflect more and changes my perspective. I mean, even as something as simple as, you know, a musical, that's not simple, but we did melodramas. That's what I was trying to think of. Nice. I was in a melodrama called The Fairest Flower of the South. And I played Mrs. Mason Dixon. And, you know, I mean, in high school, I got all the character roles, mm-hmm. like the old ladies and the funny friends. Isn't that the way it works in high school? And then once I got into the community, I started playing ingenues, which doesn't make any sense because I was older and fatter. So that's weird to me. But, you know, in high school, I was actually skinny and cute, but I kept playing all the old lady roles. I was like, that's completely backwards. But just doing something as silly as a melodrama, you know, it felt good and it felt right. And it felt like this is what I should be doing and this is exciting and this is making people laugh or this is making people think or, you know, whatever the feeling was. It was just, it sparked something.
Has that evolved as you've gotten, as your career's grown?
Oh, for sure. Nice. For sure. I mean, I definitely take it far more serious and fun now than I did in high school. But that's because I've put so much time into it in the community.
Yeah.
And in college too. I mean, I think when a lot of us are in college, we think we're the best thing ever and what we're doing is so important and what we're doing is so relevant. And it is at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doing plays that really speak about something or writing a play that really is, you know, deep. Of course, I've gone back and read plays I wrote in college that are horrible when I read them now. But at the time, they really meant something and they were saying something. And and that was exciting and that was important. But yeah, it certainly has developed and morphed and grown over the years.
Do you still write?
I do. I have a folder on my computer that is all Writings in Progress is the name of the folder. And it is jam-packed full of stuff that I've started but never finished.
Cool. Don't look at my desktop because I've got about 18 of those as well.
Right?
Yeah.
Films, short stories, plays, just all kinds of stuff.
Nice. Maybe some fan fiction with JVB.
Don't say that out loud.
Too late.
You're not listening, are you, Joe?
Joe doesn't listen to any of
don't
the
don't listen
things.
To this. Yeah. actually, that's really funny. Joe, do you remember during Two Rooms that we were starting a fan fiction play about The Walking Dead? Do you remember that? Because I do. I think one of us has that somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I bet he's still got the notebook.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I like to write. I don't think I'm very good at it, but it's a talent and a skill that I would like to elaborate a little bit more on and try to mold. I have a lot of respect for people who can write and who can clearly get whatever their story is out on paper or computer. It's hard for me. I have all these great ideas and I start and then I just can't finish.
Mm-hmm. I'm the same way. I usually chalk up my stuff to, or my lack of follow through when it comes to writing, because of, I got rehearsal. I'm spread so thin.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I mean, and my normal cop out for a lot of things nowadays is the soul sucking day job that I have. But
I hear you.
Yeah, it's what you got to do to put ramen in the fridge. Is that where you put ramen?
I think you can.
Okay, yeah, it's not going to make it any drier.
No.
I guess. Okay, good.
No.
Okay.
But it's true. I mean, I feel like, you know, if we gave ourselves deadlines, or if we were accountable to ourselves, or someone else was, you know, made us accountable to them, it would be different.
Yeah.
So yeah, if someone was like, Haley, you said you were going to start this project or this play or this film, I want to see a draft in 2 months, then I probably would have a little bit more fire to continue.
Yeah. I've often thought if money were no object, I would just audit all of Rebecca Gorman's classes at Metro. That's how I would keep writing.
Totally.
Yeah. I wrote a really funny play that now I've read since and like, oh, it's just grotesque. It's just all like dick jokes and fart jokes and There's an overheard homosexual love scene off stage. You're just like, ah!
Yeah, but like, give that to Will Ferrell and that's gold.
Yeah, it's very true. Like was it Casa de mi Padre? we'll just turn it into a Spanish play.
That's right.
It'd be really good. Spanish play sounds like a Spanish version of Macbeth.
The Spanish play.
Right.
You don't say it inside the theater.
Don't say it inside the theater. I don't even know Hollywood. That's going to be insulting. So I'm just going to stop before we get into that. So, what? Looking back at some of the stuff you've done, like now, one of the things I love about kind of having a podcast is that there has been so much theater that happened before I quote unquote showed up on the scene.
Sure.
And so, like, before I showed up, and I've talked to you about this before, like, Haley Johnson was a name I know, and everyone knows now. There's a lot of, I mean, gravitas that goes behind that. What are some of the roles that you think contributed to that? Or do you even think that that's something that you believe in or buy into? That's the word I want, phrase.
That's really nice of you to say, and that makes me feel really good. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know that that's true, or maybe I don't think that's true. And if it is true, then that's amazing, and it makes me feel good. But, you know, it's funny because there are people in this community that I've been watching and that I, before I ever fully immerse myself mm-hmm. as an actor, who I'm just like, oh, this person or that person, like,
yeah.
they're amazing, and I've seen their work for so many years, and I'm sure if I said something to them, they'd be like, oh, that's really nice of you to say, you know, no, I just, my work, you know, mm-hmm. so that's nice. I've been, like, crazy fortunate to have some really amazing opportunities over the years, and I'm aware of that, like, I'm aware of how fortunate and how lucky I am mm-hmm. To have had the privilege to work at some of the theaters I've worked at, and to work with some of the people I've worked with, directors and actors and designers and technicians. I mean, you know, I've gotten to do A Streetcar Named Desire twice. Like, who gets to say that? That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd want to do it again one day. That might just sound greedy, but, you know, it's yeah. like, it's a, once you do a show, you rarely get the opportunity to do it a second time, and then you do, and it's amazing, and you're like, how many missed opportunities
yeah.
can I take advantage of this time?
Yeah.
And now, 2 years later, I'm thinking, wow, how many missed opportunities can I take advantage of a third time that I didn't do the second time? You know,
yeah.
but that's getting, I think that sounds a little bit greedy.
No.
But maybe down the line.
If they want to pack the houses.
If they want to pack the houses, well, I mean, the title alone
yeah.
is going to get people there. But
that's true.
You know, Streetcar and doing shows. It's funny. I used to do a lot of comedy around mm-hmm. town, and I haven't in quite some time. I've been doing quite a bit of drama, you know, realistic drama, which I enjoy quite a bit. But people say to me all the time, Haley, you know, I enjoy your shows, or, you know, you do a good job or whatever, but will you please do some comedy? Like,
yeah.
you're doing a lot of really heavy stuff, and it's fun to see you on stage, but good Lord,
yeah.
can you make me laugh, please? And I'm like, wow, yeah, I kind of miss that too.
Did you go, like, on a stretch of, like, Streetcar, Two Rubes, Rabbit Hole?
Night Mother,
yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
We're just going to cry for 8 hours and just watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did throw a Bright Ideas in there at one point.
Yes, you did.
Which was super fun, and I got
yeah.
to play some super fun roles. But, yeah, I need more comedy in my life to offset the amount of tragedy that I seem to do.
Mm.
But, I mean, man, as actors, isn't that the fun stuff?
Yeah.
Like, the really tough stuff is the fun stuff. That's
yeah.
the challenge.
Definitely. I'm probably one of many who does this bad actor habit of using some forms of theater as therapy. And when I do a comedy, those are fun, and I have varying degrees of success in that. But when I do drama, like, that's where I find more of Sam Gilstrap. The
For
script
sure.
reads me more in those than in others.
Yeah, I totally relate to that.
Right.
I know exactly what you mean, and just the catharsis of it. Comedy is fantastic and so much fun, but at the same time, like, is it? I don't know. This could be a risky thing to say. Is it as fulfilling than doing something that's really going to, like, push you as an actor,
mm-hmm.
and make you reach inside yourself for, you know, more emotion or more whatever? And I'm not saying comedy is easy, because it is by no means easy, and I think you really have to challenge yourself in that
yeah.
that genre as well.
Totally.
But I don't know. I mean, I guess that's a good question, right? Like, what's more of a challenge? Comic timing and making
mm-hmm.
audiences laugh, or, like, pushing yourself to a level of dramatic realism that's so in tune that audiences understand and relate 100%.
Yeah.
That's a tough question, I think.
It is. One of the things that I keep seeing crop up, especially with my studies outside of rehearsals and stuff like that, going to a place where you're vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
and exploring that is what's really compelling, and you, trying to press your limits personally. I mean, you can get memorized, and you can read the grammar, and you can listen to the director and give him the scene picture and hit the specific notes that they're trying to come across. But, and I think I've mentioned this ad nauseum on this podcast before, but at some point, you're just kind of showing flashcards to the audience, and they don't get to connect with you. They're
right.
just answering, oh, that's sad, oh, that's anger, oh, that's so on and so forth, as opposed to feeling it and then knowing it. For a comedy, what makes comedy so great is when we can relate to it, honestly. When it's not so, I mean, some stuff about over the top, just camp,
right,
this world
right.
stuff, farcical stuff is great, and we need that just as much as we need the real comedy. But, you know, one of the people that make me laugh the most when it comes to stand-up comics are the ones that deal with gritty, vulnerable things that I think about all the time that scare me.
Right.
And I think it's possible to get to that vulnerable place in the comedy, but it kind of depends on the way it's... For those kinds of comedy, it depends on how skilled the writer is,
mm-hmm.
I would say. Because if we can go to a vulnerable place and find things to mine there, then it can be rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to maintain that over a course of an hour and a half or however long the comedy is, and not at some point just be ridiculous and unrelatable. I think.
Totally.
Nice. That was deep. Let's have another sip.
Let's do this.
Yeah. So process. There's a question I haven't been asking a lot of the people that I've had here, but yours is a process I've been intrigued by. What do you have one? Does it change from show to show? Or is it something that you're still crafting even now?
Definitely still crafting show by show and experience by experience. I mean, because we learn something new every single show, right? Like
yeah.
every single opportunity to work with new people, to work on a new script, to work in with a new company, you're learning something new. I almost think that it would be a little strange to maybe assume that, you know exactly what you're going to do every single time. Because if you're not open to be flexible and learn something and adjust your own process to the experience, then you're not fully like experiencing,
mm-hmm.
you know, the show, the rehearsal, the performance. I don't know. You know, I know a lot of people, and I admire so many people who, you know, they find out a show that they're doing. They go and buy a ton of books or like, you know, watch a bunch of YouTube or, you know, do a ton of research. And I think that's so admirable. I do a little bit of that. I don't do it as much as some people.
Mm-hmm.
Because, while I think it's important, it's different if you're doing something based on, like, real life or, you know, that for sure. But, you know, for example, now I'm just like, but for example, when you and I did Lie of the Mind,
yes.
Sam Shepard,
mm-hmm.
I was not sure at all how I was going to approach the role of Beth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, traumatic brain trauma, that's a touchy subject.
Mm-hmm.
How do you portray a character that is based on true life? That's something that could happen to somebody. So, you know, how do you do that realistically,
mm-hmm.
without accidentally mocking somebody or, you know, an audience member coming and saying, that's not at all what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
So in that instance, you know, I read a lot and I did YouTube and watched documentaries on
mm-hmm.
people who'd been in car accidents or people who... there were quite a few soldiers who had come back from war that
wow.
had dealt with traumatic brain trauma and damage. So in roles like that, I think it's imperative
yeah.
to do some pretty in-depth research because you want to be true as much as possible. But for something that's completely fictional, for Rabbit Hole, everyone said, oh, did you, you know, read a lot about grief or how did you prepare for that? And I said, no, you know, I've lived my life and I've dealt with loss, and mm-hmm. I mean, how would these given circumstances affect me?
Yeah.
As opposed to what kind of, you know, jacket and hat and scarf do I put on figuratively to create a character based off research? It's like, no, this is a real person who's dealt with grief, and most everybody I know has dealt with grief on some level,
yeah.
whether it's a pet or a grandparent or a friend or whatever. Mm-hmm. So,
or the 49ers season,
or Tuesday night's election.
Oh, yeah.
We'll not go there. Sorry.
That's not here. Let's have a drink.
Let's have a drink.
Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. America.
Mm-hmm. Oh fuck yeah, that's good.
But process, you know, process changes, and I think it's different, and I think it should be different. I feel like if it wasn't, if I did the same thing for every show, it would just be stagnant, mm-hmm. and there would be no spark to it. Mm-hmm. That's just me.
Do you have any things that, like, Patrick Stewart has this, I've heard him say a couple of times in interviews, that the first thing that he usually, the only thing he needs at a certain point in the process is to know his first do. Was the first thing that I'd do. When he did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he insisted that they put in a real locking door at the front door because that's how the play starts.
Sure.
And he said, I only need one prop. I need to check one prop. Everything else is out there on the set. All I need to do is put the key in the door and then lock the door, and I have no idea what happens when I go inside. And that's the only thing he focuses on, because at a certain point he's memorized, he's done his character work, he's comfortable in that skin, and that disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have something like that, or does that fluctuate again from show to show?
Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah.
Wow. I wish it were mine as well. I don't have anything specific. I mean, people ask me if I get butterflies or stage fright, stage fright levels of. And it's funny, I don't normally get nervous until, like, literally 60 seconds before I walk on stage, whether it's the top of the show or whenever my first scene is. I will just be standing side stage, and all of a sudden my stomach will drop. And it's the same whether it's opening night, mid-run, closing night, dress rehearsal. It doesn't matter. It's the same. It will always be the same. So I find that that's consistent. But I think that's a good sign, because if I didn't care and if I was cavalier and just ready to go on at any time, then I don't feel like I'm as focused as I should be. And it's funny, I remember in college professors telling me, you create the character, you are that person, you don't need anything else, you don't need props, you don't need costumes, it's you. And I understood that, and I agreed with that. But then when I hit the professional theatrical world and, you know, was working more in town and had more opportunities, I didn't think that was true at all. I felt like the moment I held that specific prop or put my hair back for that specific role or wore that dress, you know, that's necessary for this role or that role, that's when it really clicks for me. Mm-hmm. And I know a costume doesn't necessarily make a character or make an actor, but man, does it help.
Yeah.
Like, you can walk around in heels and a skirt in rehearsals for 4 weeks all you want, but the moment you have your actual costume and you look at yourself in the mirror and you're like, I'm about to go on as this character or that role, mm-hmm. that, for me, clicks completely.
Yeah. It's so funny. I've not encountered that a lot, but you bringing that up, I think when I played Babby Bobby at Miners,
mm-hmm.
in Cripple of Edishman, that was such a unique... I mean, it was a burlap set of overalls and a thick wool, like, corduroy coat and a beret and all this stuff, and I needed that. Like, it felt, I would put that on an hour before the show started. Everyone else is still walking in. I mean, and it's just, I just loved sitting in that and the cumbersome aspects of it all and figuring out how to move, because I'm wearing, like, a long sleeve shirt and this burlap over and this huge coat, and I'm wearing like this, like, it just, it felt like I was wearing a Gore-Tex coat, you know, that whole thing. But yeah, I mean, that's when you have those little elements that are added that really speak. I mean, because we've all had props and things like that, they're just like, oh man, I know exactly what this is for and I know what this means. But there are certain things that just kind of, that you don't, like that costume for me specifically, the second I put that on, I feel like he's got like four different pairs of this exact same set.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. That's what he wears all the time. And that then tells you everything about his life up until that first moment he comes out on stage. This is who he is. No one bothers him. He's out there by the rocks. He's working on his boat. And then you can create all the other things. Like, I think that was the first show too. Like, once I had the costume, I was like, can we put my wife's name on the boat that I'm working on? And I ripped that off on closing night, and that's on my window.
That's interesting, because I remember you putting Lainey in blood in two rooms.
Yeah.
That sounds like a thing for you.
I'm a huge, if I've got a character that's had love and any type of form for another person,
mm-hmm.
I've got to try and manifest it somewhere, because that's something that I hunger for, and is, whether it's a fallacy or not, it's something that I believe is the most important thing in this world. That's what I'm holding on to. That grounds me instantly.
Yeah.
So, like, to have something like that to work on, I needed that, because it was the one thing I could see all the time when I was sitting in that corner, like what I was working on. So, to putting Lainey's name there. And that was, especially near the end, like, I could work on that and touch it and go into the next moment.
That's incredible.
Thank you.
Well, it's funny. I mean, just kind of going back a little bit on the costume issue. When I did Night Mother, for instance, in the script, it says that Jessie wears, you know, jeans and an oversized sweater with pockets that she keeps her cigarettes and her notepad and stuff in.
Yeah.
And that's all it says. And that's fine, but I disagreed. I mean, that, you know, if you look through any production history photos of any production ever done, that's what the way the character's dressed. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's fine. But I asked for sweatpants, and, well, no, she's in sweatpants because it's her son's pants, but I asked for a giant oversized button-up shirt because, to me, it was her father's shirt, like something she would just pull out of his closet and put on to do stuff around the house.
Yeah.
And that made sense to me. And the other thing, I think, like, when we're talking about, like, something that clicks for you or, that, you know, process-wise that works, I remember asking Billy McBride, who directed, if it was okay if I had wet hair at mm-hmm. the top of the show. And she said, sure, you know, I don't see any problem. Why not? But why? I mean, why, out of curiosity? And I said, I think she knows exactly what she's doing. I mean, she's preparing to kill herself by the end of the play. So she has taken a shower. She's got, you know, washed her hair. She's gotten everything in order. Her room is all clean and organized.
Mm-hmm.
It made sense to me.
Yeah.
And so I think the moment right before going on stage, I was backstage wetting my hair.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of those moments that you could feel everything kind of like click in or move into gear or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of one of those dumb actor things, right? Like, it's not in the script, but all of us have that one thing that we're like, but this is important to me, so I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And if the director's like, cool, then cool. And then it really helps.
Yeah, it's funny, these quirks I thought I was going to spend the vast majority of my acting career avoiding when I first started. And now, I don't know if I need them, but I love it when I've got them.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when they don't feel so, like, sometimes I have to manufacture stuff. And when it sounds like, I mean, that's the explanation for Night Mother. I mean, that's perfect. And that's exactly what I get when I read it and when I saw it, is from start to finish, this is all preparing Mom, but it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Made my decision. And to have, like, oh, shit, yeah. This is, now it's fresh. Like, now we just got out of the bath, but let's go to work,
mm-hmm.
more or less. And that's really cool. I mean, but when it's manufactured for me, like, I was going to give you an example, but I don't have it, so I'm going to stop with that example.
Well, maybe we don't want to call out any specific examples of things
exactly.
that have been made.
I don't want to give away all my tricks, people. Stay tuned for more. Yeah, we're not cutting to commercial. What are some of the things you've got lined up? What's, like, happening next? The great actor question that we always give post-show.
Yeah, the one thing that, like, anytime you're at a social event, you see other actors, you're like, so, what are you working on?
Yeah, and then the second we get our answer, it's back to the bar.
Right.
Yeah.
But you kind of feel like a jerk, too, because it's like, why can't we just talk about something other than shop, right?
Well, that's the thing, too, is, like, I've asked people, like, hey, so how's the fam doing? And I get the answer, and then that's, like, the end, the conversation ends again.
Right,
and
you're like,
well, so. What do you think about process?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So then I started a podcast. to just have those two same conversations.
And get it all out.
Get it all out.
That's right.
I can record it. Me and you never have to talk again after today.
But I hope we do.
We will.
Yeah.
So, like, next? How about, like, a couple days from now next?
Let's do that. Let's talk about what's happening. Something I think we need now more than ever after this week.
Now more than ever, November 8th, 2016. There is an event happening Monday, November 14th, and Tuesday, November 15th at Vintage Theater called After Orlando. And it's this really incredible theater action is what it's being called. It's a theater action. And I think that's exactly right, the right term. There were scripts written from playwrights across the country, all 10-minute shorts or less. And all of them were in response to the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando earlier this year, or this summer. And this theater action that is occurring is happening across the country and actually across the world. There are productions happening in the UK as we speak. And what it is basically is taking, you can either do all of the readings, I think there's like 50 or maybe there's 70, I don't even know. I have not had the time to read them all. However, I can tell you someone who has, and that's Jeffrey Newman.
Nice.
Playwright extraordinaire in town, has read all of the scripts, and he curated 13 of them that the new company Benchmark Theater is producing in town. They're spearheading this project, and it's a collaborative project of getting a bunch of theater companies, artistic companies, businesses around town to collaborate on this project, to come together to present readings of some of these pieces, as just an evening of collective appreciation and love and support and honor of the horrible tragedy that happened in Orlando, and unfortunately the horrible tragedy that happens all too often in this country. And the cool thing is all of the proceeds are going to the Human Rights Campaign. That wasn't a necessity. It wasn't asked when we organized this project. It was something that Benchmark Theater thought was important.
Nice.
'Cause isn't that what art's about, is supporting others and creating a voice and, you know, spreading love and communication and conversation?
Mm-hmm. Who are all the theater companies involved?
So let's see, Benchmark is spearheading it and also presenting some pieces. Athena Project,
nice.
Buntport,
okay.
Curious,
ooh.
Boulder Ensemble Theater Company,
cool.
Local Theater,
nice.
Funky Little Theater Company from the Springs, Vintage. I'm probably leaving somebody out because that's what happens when you don't look at your list. But we do. We have a great... good group of companies that were excited to be involved. And on top of that, we even have special guest appearances by the Denver Gay Men's Chorus that's coming out to sing, which is great. They've been super supportive of the Orlando community since everything happened, and they jumped on the opportunity to come and be a part of this project as well.
Nice. How much are tickets?
Tickets are $25. Like I said, all the proceeds, I mean, it's a benefit, so all the proceeds are going to the Human Rights Campaign. There's a $25 ticket. There's also what's called an ally ticket, which is $40, and that's the cost of admission, preferred seating, and then an additional $15 direct donation to the Human Rights Campaign.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, yeah, tickets are going fast, so people should jump on it.
Definitely, yeah. That's Monday and Tuesday next
Monday
week.
And Tuesday night.
Very cool.
At Vintage Theater.
So what is Benchmark? How did this happen? Are you fully involved? Or?
Yeah, I am. I co-founded Benchmark Theater with local actress director Rachel Bouchard.
Mm-hmm.
We started a theater company that is not at all daunting, but we really were excited at the prospect of starting something that focused a lot on community collaboration.
Nice.
And I think we do see that in this community. I think we could see more of it.
Mm-hmm.
because, as I said, you know, supporting one another, working with one another, that's one of the best ways to share art, to create art, is by getting as many voices in one room to lift one another up or tear each other down, depending on what direction you want to go, what you want to create, who you want to support. So yeah, Benchmark Theater is just this new theater company in town that's all about community collaboration, whether it, and not just the artistic community, but the local businesses. I mean, it's so important for local businesses to support one another, to market one another, to cross promote, because isn't that what we need, is just to lift one another up constantly?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, how do you move forward otherwise?
I mean, we're, the community here, I think, by and large, really kind of, to a certain degree, understands that we're all on the same team.
Right.
I mean, it is, I would say, a saturated market, but there is, that doesn't diminish the quality of stuff that's happening on different points of the, I mean, there's something great in every community. I mean, you can go out to Creed and see great theater. You can go out to Golden and see great, Evergreen, great theater. Lakewood's got great theater.
Family Theater Company.
Yeah.
That was the other one I forgot to mention.
Nice.
And I knew it was an important one.
Yeah.
Talking about, you know, opportunity and diversity.
Mm-hmm. That's huge that you've been able to bring them in.
And then look at the kind of work that they've done over the years.
Oh my God. I mean, they're up for Henry's every year.
They're on a national platform.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And why wouldn't you want to support a company that is so inclusive to the kind of people that they want to support,
mm-hmm.
that they want to, you know, help shine through the community,
mm-hmm.
to help prove that all people are capable people.
Nice.
All actors, all technicians, all artists are capable.
Yeah. We've got to, I mean, like I said, we're all on the same team as far as actors are concerned, but it's just people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the same thing. If you were to diminish any one person for some perceived lack of ability, even if it is something as physical as some of those things can be, if you just make the judgment, oh, they're done now,
mm-hmm.
you diminish the whole. That's something you believe. You got to support that in any walk of life.
For sure.
Because even if you find it to be taxing to try and bring them along until they're at a place where they can do it on their own, and you find that draining or whatever, then if you just let go of that judgment and learn from that, you'll take more patience into everything you do, and that's going to make you a lot less stressed and a lot happier, I think.
Yep.
I kind of went on a little spiritual rant there.
That was lovely.
Thank you. No, I appreciate it. That's great. But is there anything happening with Benchmark separate from
After Orlando?
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually just completed casting for our first inaugural production.
Oh, sweet. What's that going to be?
The Nether.
Ooh.
By Jennifer Haley will open March 31st. At
another comedy, right?
It's another light, frothy, delightful evening of comedy. Not at all. The Nether is written by Jennifer Haley,
mm-hmm.
and it's a regional premiere.
Mm.
That's always exciting. And it's going to be presented at Buntport starting on March 31st. And it's this kind of crazy, relevant, dramatic, slightly... It's funny, when I say that it has slight sci-fi undertones, I get a lot of, oh God, I don't know if I want to see that. And I say, no, not... sci-fi like Aliens from Outer Space.
Nice.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Let's
yeah.
be clear.
That's right.
But it's kind of this cool script that like questions what's beyond tomorrow. Like what's going to happen 2 weeks from now? What could happen a month from now? What could happen 5 years down the line? Just in terms of humanity, of what we create, of who we can become. And it's this just morality tale of, you know, what's right, what's wrong, where's the line, and how can you cross that line? It's funny, talking about Walking Dead earlier. Where's the line of, like, what's too grotesque and what's
yeah.
not? It's a really interesting script that I think is going to start conversations and make people think, and I think it's going to be uncomfortable for some people, but that's another reason that we like to do what we do, right? Is to kind of push the envelope a little bit and open people's eyes and minds just a little bit more than they may already be.
Oh, definitely. I mean, as actors, we want to find what makes us vulnerable so we can grow more and explore more of that character or the play as a whole. But as people, we may not know it, but when we're in uncomfortable situations, when we're pressed, we learn just how, learn exactly what we think about certain things mm-hmm. and how we can handle them.
For sure.
And if you can get an audience to that place where they're teetering on the edge of, that's great stuff. That's good theater.
Yeah, I enjoy that as an audience member, kind of being pushed to a level of uncomfort, but not like physical uncomfort, but yeah. just kind of like an emotional, psychological, spiritual, wow, how do I feel about this? Mm-hmm. What would I do in this situation? It just kind of, I think, broadens your perspective a little bit sometimes.
I'm fishing for like a big boom for my podcast. Can you announce the cast, or is that going to be another time?
I can't.
Ah.
Only because that is Rachel Bouchard's call as,
right.
director,
as the director
of the show.
I totally get it. I totally get it. Sorry, Rachel. Trying to steal your thunder.
Sorry, Rachel. I respect you. I maybe, had I had another glass of wine, would have let it slip.
There's still another glass in this
bottle. I know.
But
Rachel would have killed me.
We'll talk about other things. We'll talk about other things. Because you have to go to rehearsal, right?
I have an After Orlando rehearsal in a little while. We're fine.
Oh, good. Good.
Well, oh, we have plenty of time.
Nice.
I can say, this was already known, but myself and Mark Stith.
Who?
Mark Stith. I think you may have done a podcast with him.
Oh, that's right. He's a Royals fan.
Yeah, he's that Royals fan.
As I spit into the air.
He and I will both be in the Nether. And that's exciting because cool. we've done two shows in the past.
Yeah.
And we like working with one another.
Definitely.
So
Shadowbox and then Rabbit.
That's right.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nice.
This time we will not be playing husband and wife.
What?
Shocker. Spoiler.
Get out of town. My God. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Those are two very popular and good actors in that show.
Thank you. Yeah. And kind of going back to what I was saying earlier about young actors, there is a young actress in our show who is 11 years old.
Wow.
And it's some pretty tough material.
Nice.
But to have, we had amazing, amazing girls come out to audition and come to callbacks. Just some really incredible talent.
Nice.
And that's tough
yeah.
for a role that's written to be so young, mm. to not only have really amazing, mature, talented actresses available and interested, but also, you know, comfortable enough, or whose parents are comfortable enough with the material. I mean, like I said, it's tough material. And it's something that we need to be open with them and with their parents about, because, you know, again, if you're going to start asking questions and starting conversations, you need to make sure everyone's on the same page.
Yeah, no, if we're hiding things from people or sugarcoating, that's what I'm trying to get at. If we're sugarcoating things, we'll never fully get what's trying to be said, and we'll miss out on a lot of things. Some of it can be jarring, and it can be tough to deal with. It can be grotesque, and it can be scary.
Yeah.
But we'll have to toughen up at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a time and place for decency, but then there's also a time and place for honesty, and I would say that that's every time.
That should be every time.
It should be
shouldn't
every
it?
Time. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. I own a pair of gold underpants. Everybody, there. I said it. I said it. I wanted to be honest with you.
The next show we do together, you're wearing them to our first dress rehearsal.
Oh, no, I'll wear them for opening night.
Even yeah. better.
Yeah, totally.
Because I mean, fashion is what?
The goddamn motherfucker.
Correct.
That's right.
Hashtag that.
I did. I've done
all
it many times.
All the time.
All the time. Take a look at my watches, baby. Oh, I'm obnoxious. We've been doing this for about 55 minutes. This
no
is fantastic.
Way.
Yeah, we're almost there.
That's incredible.
The countdown. I mean, I like it when we're able to.
It's the final countdown. Da-da-da-da.
Da-da-da-da. We're just going to keep doing this till we get to 55.
The final countdown. Yeah. Like I said, I'm not a singer.
But
I'm going to rock the 80s so hard.
I'm only singing inside my car and at a karaoke bar when the vast majority of people is drunk enough to think, oh, he's good.
I will only sing one song at karaoke, and I've only done it one time.
What is this?
It's Tears for Fears. Everybody Wants to Rule the World.
Why have we not gone to Armida's yet?
you know, it's a rare occasion that I'll let that slip out.
How many shots of tequila are we doing before that happens?
A decent number.
It's like a decent 4?
Oh.
The over under 4?
I could probably do less than 4 and get up and sing that song.
Okay,
good. I don't sing it well, but it's the only song I'll sing.
Oh, that's totally fine.
All right. No, yeah. As long as we're clear.
Yeah, no, yeah, totally. So next Saturday, everybody, we'll be at our meet is pushing the Patron on Haley Johnson.
And if you see some random chick in all black singing Tears for Fears, that's me.
Yeah, yeah. And some random dude in all black in a weird hat and a big watch singing Ordinary People by John Legend. That's me.
See?
Yeah.
This is going to happen.
No, it will. We'll have to make it happen.
Is JVB going to be there for posterity?
Fuck. We need Pete. We need JVB. We need the whole clan.
You hear that? You're all coming.
That's right. Kelly Uhlenhop, you're going to sing too.
I can't wait to see that.
Oh my God. Yeah. Just keep pushing sodas on everybody. Whiskey for Pete, soda for Kelly. JVB will drink whiskey too.
All right.
And as long as I've got Patron, I'm happy.
Man, I haven't been to Armitas in years.
Oh my God.
I used to go all the time.
I go every once in a while, and it's usually right after I've been done being sick. So it's the first time I can sing and not hurt myself.
See, for me, when I'm sick, I sound better. I'm like Kathleen Turner. I'm like, I've got this great smoky low voice.
Well, that's great if you're not singing. Like, you were talking about, like, opening weekend of Two Rooms. I just got done being sick when we opened that show. So everything I said was like, oh, Lainey, how I miss you and the way they treat me and I've got a beard.
That's right. And then you, like, sniffle and it's all...
And it's all snot and blood at the same time. That was a fun night when I got too much blood up my nose. Ugh. Yeah. But anyway.
Theater stories.
This is the Ghost Lights. We like to have a little fun. But one of the things I'm really excited that we do every episode is leave the audience with a message. Whether that's something you wanted to hear when you got started and never did, or something that you've learned now that you'd like to share. What is the thing that you'd leave the ghost light on for people?
You know, you could say the cliche things, which I probably would normally say, like, you know, don't give up on your dreams, and if it's right for you, keep moving forward. But based off this week and the state of the nation, I just want to say, let's all be kind to one another. I don't think that people need to accept decisions or be okay with whatever has happened or what direction you feel. But let's just be kind to one another, because we're all one group. Mm-hmm. We're all working for the common good, and that's just to be a strong, positive, healthy nation of people that want to support one another and love one another. And let's just, you know, be kind. Let's not text and drive.
Yeah, that's a good message.
Let's just, you know, let someone in traffic and wave to someone when they do, and hold a door open for somebody and say thank you when they do that. And let's try to just get through this week and this month and this year and the next 4 years and the next 8 and whatever is going to be gracefully and positively.
I really hope you're not prognosticating a re-election.
I'm not, but, you know, let's hope that doesn't happen. But 4 years, 8 years, 20 years, 50 years, let's try to be kind and keep our faces out of our phones a little bit. I think that's something I've noticed a lot, is just people don't say hi anymore.
Yeah.
They're too busy on their phones.
Yeah.
And I understand, because that's kind of the way technology has moved along. But, you know, smile at somebody or say hello or hold the door open. And I think that's going to go a long way to make someone else's day brighter.
It's amazing how the common courtesies have become so important now.
Yeah.
And it's the thing that contributed to their falling off, is that they were common and they were small little things that, for at least the way old movies taught me, always happen. I'm a guy that, like, if we're passing each other on a sidewalk and I smile at you and you look away, you're instantly an asshole, and I hope you stub your toe on the next block. I don't care. Like, that's just
I hear you.
That's instantly where my mind goes.
I hear you.
I'm
Go ahead.
No, I'm also a big guy on, if we're out together, like, or we're doing stuff, totally, it's cool that you got your phone, but if we're just in the phone all the time and not talking about fantasy football, I feel sad.
I completely understand.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny because it's the cliche of, like, seeing someone out to dinner with mm-hmm. friends and everyone's on their phone. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, just in life, in general, in theater, in art, in love, be kind to one another and give each other more than just a moment of your time.
Definitely.
Smile, say hello. You don't have to mean it, but at least be nice enough to try.
I will say one caveat, though, to all that. If you're listening to this Ghost Lights podcast via your phone, by all means, ignore the rest of the world.
Keep your face in your phone.
Keep your face in your phone. This is important. we're gonna have a selfie here in a little bit. There's more wine to be drunk. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. Haley Johnson, thank you so much for joining me tonight. We'll do this again. If not in reality, having a conversation over some drinks, over the recorded airwaves.
Let's do it. Nice. I'm pleased as punch. I'm pleased as Oregon Pinot Gris to be here.
It's awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, Monday and Tuesday, that is the 14th and the 15th of November. Please go to Vintage, support After Orlando. It is a great cause. I hope to make it there. At the very least, work together and create positive, thought-provoking art. After this, go see The Nether, support Benchmark Theater, support any local theater if you hear this. Thank you, guys. As we sign out, we leave you with the dulcet tones of the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble.